This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thanks so much for listening. October 17th is Thursday. It's approaching fast, and lawmakers are still trying to come up with a deal to extend the country's borrowing limit. At the center of the dispute now is a disagreement over how long a stopgap spending measure to reopen the government should last. Senate Democrats refused to move on Sunday to any deal that locks in budget cuts, that's sequestration, for all of 2014. They want to replace those cuts. Some lawmakers say they're not even sure what the fight is about anymore. Senator Claire McCaskill on the Senate floor yesterday said, "It feels like we're boxing shadows." Joining the program now is Virginia Republican Congressman Scott Ridgel. Congressman Ridgel represents Virginia's 2nd congressional district, and he was the only Republican House member to vote with Democrats to avoid the shutdown without defunding or delaying the Affordable Care Act. Now he's got a new plan to reopen the government and says he could garner bipartisan support. He joins me now. Congressman, hello.
Hello, Todd.
So let's just remind people, your district, the 2nd District of Virginia, that's the Tidewater area. That's Virginia Beach. Lots of
district, highest concentration, Todd, of men and women in uniform in the country, active duty and retired.
Yep.
A beautiful part of the country and one that is hurting right now because of the shutdown. And that's one reason that I've been so adamant that we need to reopen the government. And absent any other viable plans that I saw being floated, that's the reason that I offered the America First plan.
Now, you've got lots of military bases, of course, a couple air bases. Norfolk is in your district, so that's, and it's a swing district also. People should know that it's kind of oscillated back and forth between Republicans.
It reflects America, Todd, which is unlike what's the case with so many of our congressional districts. I really believe we gerrymandered ourselves into a situation where these districts, the way they've been gerrymandered, they're really ripping our country apart from a political standpoint.
So what's going on right now in the Capitol is that there may be a deal on the continuing resolution, reopen the government, and the debt ceiling. That'll probably happen this week, we think.
Well, I hope so. Yes.
But then the point is to try to move on to a larger budget negotiation between Republicans and Democrats, and that's where you come in.
Well, this must be done. You know, it's true that we need to reopen the government, but it's also true and equally true that we must go ahead and begin the process of reforming mandatory spending and reconciling, you know, the difference between our revenues and our expenditures. And I think what's unique about the America First plan is that it represents things that Democrats will like and Republicans will like it, and conversely, it represents some things that both parties will have some objection to. But that's the only way this is going to get through because, look, I'd love to put forth a plan that just reflected my views. And I certainly have, you know, a plan in my own mind, at least, that would get us through this. But I know that to get anything done, to make something into law and to really make a difference, we have to have the support of our Democratic colleagues. And so I've grabbed the third rail of Republican politics, which is to say that we need more revenue, not only through growth and principally through growth, but also through some changes in the tax code, but simultaneously we're wrestling with this idea of it slowing down the rate of growth, not cutting, but slowing down the rate of growth of mandatory spending. And I think that's where the rational center is in our country. And that's why I think it has bipartisan support and appeal.
So when you say mandatory spending, of course, that means Medicare and Social Security primarily.
Yeah,
and this is what you're describing has always been the grand bargain. This has always been the thing that failed between Speaker Boehner and the White House in 2011.
Well,
it's the thing that led to the supercommittee.
Well, by the way, Todd, you know, my background is I'm an automobile dealer, a Ford dealer in my second term, first elected office. And I say that because I think that an incremental approach here is what's called for. I don't know that my plan is a grand bargain, but it is an incremental approach. It's like, where can we find common ground? And all of the reforms that I've presented reflect ideas that Democrats and Republicans have one time or another have already agreed on. We really owe it to our children, our grandchildren, to get a hold of this. I know my Democratic friends, I've spoken with them, they are troubled by our fiscal situation. And so this idea that Democrats don't care about the debt and Republicans don't care about the environment, for example, or the poor, I just reject these stereotypes. I really think that before we're anything else, we're Americans, and we owe it to our children to compromise in a reasonable way and do what's right for them, or the next generation of Americans.
Before we let you go, Congressman Ridgel, last question. President Obama has gone around the last couple of years saying that he has been willing to go against Democrats and say, we got to trim Social Security. You're saying Republicans should be willing to talk about revenue. They haven't been. My question is, will you be willing to gather together congressional moderate Republicans and put pressure on the leadership to actually accept revenue, to sort of counter the Tea Party on this?
That's my mission, Todd, every day. And I really implore my Democratic colleagues to meet me halfway on this, to saddle up with some of these reforms that must be done on mandatory spending. You can't tax your way out of this. It's got to be an acceptable ratio, of reform to revenue. And we ought to really focus on growth, too, Todd. This is, I think, common ground. It does exist in Washington. At least I approach my job every day believing that's the case.
Congressman Scott Ridgel from Virginia's 2nd District, the Tidewater region. Congressman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
It's the final countdown for the government debt ceiling, at least. On Thursday, unless Congress acts, the U.S. will be in default for the first time in the nation's history. With only a few days left until the deadline, some of America's most important investors from abroad aren't too happy. Listen to China's Vice Finance Minister Zhu Guangyao speaking on the issue.
The U.S. totally understands that we are concerned about developments in the U.S. fiscal cliff and ask the United States to heed the reasonable demand to ensure the safety of Chinese investments.
And the director of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, had this to say on NBC's Meet the Press over the weekend.
If there was a combination of the government shutdown for a period of time and, more seriously, more damaging, if the debt ceiling was not lifted with a degree of certainty, that would bring about so much uncertainty, so much risk of disruption, that the standing of the U.S. economy would again be at risk. It would mean massive disruption the world over.
To get an idea of how the rest of the world is reacting to this potential default, I talked to Lord Digby Jones. Lord Jones is former UK Minister of State for Trade and Investment and former head of the Confederation of British Industry. He says the shoe is now on the other foot.
It would be fair to say there's a fair little bit of sniggering and a little bit of schadenfreude about it, I guess. Maybe brought about by a few years of the Americans saying to the Europeans, get your act together, the EU's, the Eurozone's in crisis, all of that stuff. Now the biter is bit, and there's a fair bit of that around. And of course, that will inhibit these two amazing trading blocks, you know, America and the European Union. It'll inhibit a bit of that coming together more easily in negotiations for things like a free trade agreement and whatever. It just puts an obstacle in the way. Does it mean anything at the end of the day? No. But it just is a bit of sentiment we could do without. Britain sees it a bit differently than the rest of Europe. We are your best friend. We are your greatest trading partner in the European Union, even more so than Germany. And America is the biggest investor in Britain. And so with us, you're talking to family in many ways. So we see it a bit differently. I think we understand you a bit better. For instance, the average European cannot understand why, and I have to say I find this a bit difficult, you elect a president. The president then says, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and if you elect me, I will do it. You elect him, for better or worse, welcome to democracy. He then says, I'm going to do these things and does it. And then along come a minority and holds the whole of the United States, the biggest economy on earth, to ransom. Just a few people with a radical view. They are entitled to the view. That is what freedom means. But are they entitled to hold the entire economy to ransom on it? A Brit finds that very difficult.
I was going to say, Lord Jones, and a great many Americans ask the exact same question that the Brits are asking. You know, there's been a story bouncing around here lately that people are fond of, which is when there was a government shutdown, I believe, in a corner of the Commonwealth called Australia a couple of decades ago. Well, the Queen just fired everybody and dissolved the parliament and ordered a new one. And maybe that made people long for the monarchy here, somebody who could just put a stop to it.
Well, I think that was probably done by the Prime Minister in her name, but I know what you mean. There is a permanency about it which does stabilize at times of crisis. As the Western democracies come out of the worst recession since the 1930s, the last thing on earth we need is one of the great champions of democratic capitalism. And you have your problems. You're a protectionist nation, which you always deny, but you are. But you are this fabulous beacon of freedom and democratic capitalism at a time when there are a lot of countries in Asia's century that can't hold up that beacon with any pride. Now, the last thing on earth we need is for that to be shown to have faults, for that to be shown to cause a problem. And if there is a debt default, then you begin to get a domino effect. You begin to get other banks who've lent to other banks having to default. You begin to get other creditors coming into those other banks and having to default. And suddenly you get share prices, stock prices marked down. You get debt levels and interest rates going up. Credit is hard to come by, and bang, suddenly small businesses in many parts of the world have a real problem accessing liquidity, and they start laying people off, and confidence goes down, and you're into a form of downturn or recession brought about not by economic performance or banks or manufacturing or property, whatever, real estate being wrong, none of that, brought about by just a few politicians in a minority actually holding the country to ransom. It'll be a long time before a small business who is affected because of it forgives America.
Everybody says we've seen this movie before. They'll
exactly.
settle it. Does Europe
exactly.
believe that?
I mean, they think basically, we've seen the movie before, pass the popcorn because it'll all be sorted out before the end of the reel. But if it didn't, I think the difference is, if this had been happening 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, there would have been a great deal of frustration. There would have been a great deal of anger. But there wouldn't have been a lot that other parts of the world could do because America was omnipotent. America was number one. Its hegemony was complete. Today, America is not omnipotent. America has company at the top table. She's not coming off number one slot, but she is having company on the number one slot. China is definitely going to share first place with America. You know, America can't rely anymore on saying, I know this is a little bit of adolescence and I'm really sorry, but don't get too cross because it'll be all right in any way. You want me to spend all my money around the world and you want us to be a customer of choice, so put up with it. Suck it up. Get on. This time round, there'll be a few countries that will just say, in the medium term, nothing the day after, that if they have choice. And if the choice is, well, it's between an American and another one, well, last time they let us down, don't think we'll do it again.
This behavior, Lord Jones warns America, you're only hurting yourself, and this time it could actually make a real difference. That is Lord Digby Jones, former head of the Confederation of British Industry and former UK Trade and Investment Minister. Lord Jones, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. All the best to you.
Today is Columbus Day, of course, a short work week for some of you. Later this hour, we talk about the benefits of a compressed work week. That's 4 10-hour days instead of 5 8-hour days. What would you do with the extra time?
This is Laura. I live in Delaware. I do have Fridays off. It's amazing. I use them to pursue hobbies like crafts and sewing, clean my house, run errands, and most importantly, go to happy hour.
We always want to hear from you. 8778-MY-TAKE. You can call us or facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry. Long before women had the right to vote, there were pioneers who pushed for higher education for women. Pioneers like educator Mary Lyon, who back in 1873 founded Mount Holyoke College, or Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, as it was known at the time. That's in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Mount Holyoke was the first of the so-called Seven Sisters, seven liberal arts schools created only for women in response to the Ivy League schools that originally only allowed men. Well, today, many women's colleges across the country are struggling to survive. Studies show that fewer than 3% of college-bound women consider attending a single-sex college these days. Recently, with declining enrollment, trustees at a number of women-only schools have opted to go co-ed. It's actually been going on for years. Many female students like this one have been disappointed.
It was an outrage. I'm going to be doing criminal justice still, but I'm going to go to another school that has a better program.
That's Megan Badahu from Pine Manor College, just outside Boston, one of the women's only colleges that has recently decided to go co-ed. Badahu is one of the students interviewed by WGBH higher education reporter Kurt Carapeza. I spoke to Kurt along with Lynn Pascarella, the president of Mount Holyoke College, and I asked Kurt what's going on at Pine Manor, why they went co-ed now.
Well, the interim president at Pine Manor College, Dr. Joseph Lee, told me enrollment has dropped dramatically from more than 500 students in the 1990s to about 350 today. Todd, basically he said the bottom line is the market is really competitive. He thinks that the business model for women's colleges is no longer sustainable, and the college needed to turn co-ed in order to survive.
We think that we are much more appealing to both men and women at this point in time. So we think we'll increase the female enrollment, and obviously the men will be new folks on campus. And sustainability, as we go into the future, I think it gives us a much better shot at sustainability.
Okay, Kirk, that's fine, but it makes me wonder if there's something in particular about women's colleges that makes them less of a buy or less attractive to female students. Do they want to go to co-ed places? I mean, the colleges are still as good as they always were, right?
Sure, the quality remains there, and some schools like Wellesley College and Mount Holyoke continue to thrive, but many women's colleges are struggling to maintain enrollment. Pine Manor and going co-ed isn't alone. Earlier this year, Wilson College in Pennsylvania voted to go co-ed, and last year, Georgian Court in New Jersey went co-ed.
Well, Lynn Pascarella at Mount Holyoke, your name has been invoked, or the name of your institution, so let's turn to you. Enrollment at your school is thriving, and it makes me want to ask what you think Mount Holyoke is doing right.
Well, I think it goes back to whether the model for higher education in the United States is sustainable. We can't continue to raise tuition, have burgeoning loan burdens at a time when the added value of a college education is being called into question. Particularly challenging is making the case for liberal education as opposed to pre-professional or vocational education. The colleges you mentioned, including Mount Holyoke, are thriving. We have a long history of women's education. We also meet full financial need for our students. And so our students aren't leaving with a lot of debt.
These days, though, Lynn Pascarella, what's the added value for a young woman at a women's only college? I can see it, of course, with Wellesley. Hey, look at all that prestige. Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, the list goes on. And I know there are famous alumni from your school, too. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, what's the value for a young woman in a women's-only college today, do you think?
Well, women's education is empowering. It provides opportunities for leadership that aren't available at coeducational institutions. There have been recent studies out of Yale, out of Princeton, showing that there continues to be hidden bias. So if a resume with a woman's name is identical to a resume with a man's name, the man is more likely to get a job and a higher salary. So the opportunity to address those biases.
Kurt Carapeza, you're finding, though, that maybe that added value that Lynn Pascarella is talking about might be more attractive these days to foreign students, women from overseas who want to come to the U.S. for their education.
Sure. I think as these mid-tier women's colleges see their enrollment drop, they're increasingly looking abroad and trying to recruit international students. This is no surprise. Recruitment at higher education institutions has become a big business. And no one's claiming that there's no need for women's college, just that the supply needs to really equal the demand. When I spoke with the admissions director at Mount Holyoke last week, she told me that their international enrollment has spiked from 10%, around 2001 to more than 25% today. So they're increasingly dependent on those foreign students to meet their enrollment.
Lynn Pascarella, when I was a kid, I went to summer camp in Massachusetts with my sister for a summer, and I remember that the girls' groups were all named for traditionally female colleges, for women's colleges. There was Radcliffe, Smith, Vassar, Skidmore were all the names of the girls' bunks, and I went down the list. Only one of those that I mentioned is still an all-women's college. Smith, Vassar, Skidmore, Radcliffe are all co-ed now.
Yes. There's been a dramatic decrease in the number of women's colleges, and the reasons for going co-ed vary from the philosophical reasons around access and affordability, changing missions, and economic considerations.
But you say philosophically that a woman's education, even in the year 2013, is still something that young women can value for their university experience.
Oh, I think it's extremely valuable. We have a partnership with the Department of State around women in public service. The goal is to have 50% of the leaders in public service be women by 2050. Those kinds of partnerships are critical, recognizing the situation of women around the world where women still are denied access to education. So there is a moral obligation to redress the kind of discrimination against women in education. And we have a historic mission in our country of educating for democracy.
Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, I want to thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Also, Kirk Carapeza, WGBH higher education reporter. Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you, Todd.
One-third of workplaces offered a compressed work week at least part of the year. That's 4 10-hour days with an extra day off. What would you do with the extra time?
This is Amanda calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. I have been trying to find a boss that would let me work 4 days a week so that I could be a mycologist 4 days and the painter I wish I were the other 3 days of the week. Dream come true it would be.
Tell us your dream at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. That's all one word, at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry. While women's colleges aren't the only form of higher education seeing a major shift these days, the GED, or General Educational Development Certificate, goes all the way back to World War II, to 1942, when it helped GIs who had their education interrupted get ready for a return to the workforce. Well, there are big changes on the way for the GED today. 30 million adults in the United States are without a high school degree. 700,000 of them take the GED test every year. Two new competitors, however, will begin offering high school equivalency testing in January, while the GED itself will no longer be a pen and paper exam, but it's going to be a computer-based system. Now, you can imagine that this also means a price increase for test takers in a lot of states. What do all these changes mean for those people seeking high school equivalency and their prospects for employment? Here to help answer that question, Marcy Foster, a policy analyst at the Center for Law and Social Policy, or CLASP, a nonprofit that advocates for low-income people. Hi, Marcy.
Hi.
Well, Marcy, it raises the question, why change it? Is there evidence or a sense that the current GED is inadequate, too easy, or needs to have this change?
There is a general movement towards thinking about having high school equivalencies that need to prepare students just for college down the road, and not just for having a high school equivalency and that being the end point, but preparing them for higher skilled employment and transitions to post-secondary education after they receive a GED or a high school equivalency.
There has to be a risk, I suppose, that if the test is a lot harder, more difficult to take, or requires more background knowledge, that a lot of people might just avoid it altogether.
That's certainly a concern. And every time the GED changes, the population has to adjust to the new content, certainly. But I think the way that the test is being administered, the rigor is increasing, but the cut score in terms of what it means to have a GED has not yet been determined. And so the test may actually, we still may have the same number of people passing the GED. I think all of that is yet to be determined. We'll have to see how the rollout goes in 2014.
Well, when we talk about the test getting more difficult how? What is the new test going to look like that's not on the current test?
The new content of the GED will include increased rigor such as higher math standards and higher science standards. There's also going to be a new focus on college and career readiness. So for the first time, the GED will have two cut scores. One will certify that you have a high school equivalency diploma, and the second will certify that you are college and career ready.
I mentioned before that the test is getting more expensive. That's got to be concerning to a lot of people who are low income already. How much more expensive is it getting?
The test cost of the test is still determined at the state level. However, in many states, we're hearing reports that if they keep the GED, and we know that many states are not keeping the GED, they're switching to a lower cost test. In states that are keeping the GED, the cost of the test may be doubling or tripling in those states.
Marcy Foster, I'm just curious, before we let you go, what's your overall impression here? Are you happy? Are you comfortable with the direction that the GED is now taking?
The GED changes coming in 2014 are positive. They're positive changes. Focusing on alignment with college and career readiness is a positive step that will help prepare students for college, which is increasingly a prerequisite for their economic mobility. It also is the first time that states are pursuing innovations and other competitors are entering into the market, which we think is a really positive step. So for 60 to 70 years, the GED has largely been a monopoly in the high school equivalency market, but we think it's time for state innovation and competitors to enter that market and hopefully compete for those students, which would in turn potentially improve quality and access for millions of students across the country.
Well, we'll be keeping our eye on it, and I know you will be too, Marcy Foster, policy analyst at the Center for Law and Social Policy, otherwise known as CLASP. Marcy, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, let's turn back time with the help of our friends at the Retro Report.
It's a very long time since a science story on Sunday made such waves on Monday.
The news was that scientists in Scotland had successfully cloned a sheep in a laboratory.
An exact copy made by a combination of genetics, biology, and technology.
The Retro Report works in association with our partner, the New York Times, and they produce a documentary each week looking back at the events in the news archives to examine the long-lasting consequences of stories of recent history and then look critically at how those stories were originally reported. Now, what you heard there, of course, were headlines from Dolly the sheep, the clone sheep back in 1997 that rocked the scientific world and, more importantly, rocked the media world with reports of cloned mammals and what has become a cliche, a brave new world of scientific research. Matthew Spolar is producer for Retro Report, and he's here with me now. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, most of us remember Dolly the sheep and the reporting and sort of the worry about what cloning would become when a mammal was cloned and reproduced. Now it's 2013, and looking back on cloning, the prospect of copied humans and choosing blue eyes and blonde hair traits, has any of that come to pass?
Well, certainly not to that extent, but in May of this year, there was actually a finding out in Oregon that a team of scientists there were able to clone a human embryo, which was kind of at that time thought to be maybe the ghoulish prospect of this technology. But ultimately, what I think a lot of people have learned about cloning is that really the goal here was not to reproduce humans. It was to actually fight disease and to find better ways to do that. And so that really has become the focus.
And what this really became after Dolly the sheep was it became about stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research. We remember those political fights too in a process called somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is cloning, but they didn't use it to reproduce people.
Right. And actually, that technique goes back even to the 60s. There was a cloning of a frog back then. It wasn't until Dolly, really, that people took notice. But yeah, a year after Dolly, you have the first human embryonic stem cells discovered it. And then it just took off from there. I mean, that technology kind of, they're married to each other in a certain way, but ultimately this is about stem cells. The main scientists that did the Dolly experiment now work with stem cells.
And the interesting thing about your documentary, even though it's only 13 minutes long, it's fascinating, is that even that cloning process, the controversy around embryonic stem cells, a lot of that is gone because since Dolly the sheep, they've developed different ways to produce those cells that don't have the human cloning controversy. It's sort of – some of it's moot now.
Right. The Nobel Prize last year was awarded to a scientist who was able to reprogram adult cells, adult skin cells, back into stem cells. And that's a huge development because no longer do you need the embryo work that scared people so much back in 1997 and in the years afterwards.
So that research that won the Nobel Prize that you described was sort of an off-ramp to all of the controversy about embryonic stem cell research. What about on-ramps? What sort of research on-ramps have been the result of Dolly the sheep? Of course, it is now possible to clone a human embryo. We haven't seen, even though it's only been, you know, less than 15 years, we haven't seen armies of human clones, hopefully in the future, you know, in my book, but sci-fi fan. But what about the on-ramps for the actual cloning that came from Dolly the sheep? What's happened scientifically that we can attribute to that?
Well, I mean, if you have a prize dairy cow or some prime beef cattle that you think is just really great, you can go down to Texas or in Iowa. There are cloning operations there where you can get a clone made. It's going to cost you about $20,000, but that technology does exist for a price. And there are other examples of this happening with cats and dogs and that type of thing.
So lots of livestock is cloned, but we're not eating, as I understand it, a lot of cloned beef. We are eating the offspring of prized cloned steers and things like that.
Correct.
Days.
Yes. I mean, this is largely the offspring that we're talking about. There's a very small percentage of animals out there that are actually cloned. It's their offspring that the traits are needed for.
Nevertheless, very much a part of our lives. Maybe not embryonic stem cell research, but food. Maybe something even more personal. That's Matthew Spohler, our producer for Retro Report, in association with our partner, The New York Times, a new documentary on the history of Dolly the Sheep. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry. There is, of course, a mess in Washington, and there is growing uncertainty over how markets will react, even if a default crisis is averted this week. The shutdown and the debt limit fight have already taken their toll on consumer confidence. This confrontation was driven from the right, the political right, and many in the money-minded Republican establishment in Washington may finally be saying enough is enough. You've seen it from places like the Chamber of Commerce, the defense industry, big financial firms. And that frustration appears to be playing out in the state of Michigan, not just inside the Beltway with the power players. In Michigan, business leaders are steadily distancing themselves from the Tea Party activists they once supported. One example, Michigan businessman Brian Ellis. He's launching a Republican primary challenge to Congressman Justin Amash, a prominent figure in the Tea Party movement. Brian Ellis joins us now. Mr. Ellis, hello.
Hi there.
So you're launching what's sort of being touted as a reverse primary. For all these years, Republicans have been looking over their right shoulder at the Tea Party challenge and afraid of it. You're kind of reversing the trend here?
Well, yes and no. I mean, people like to portray it that I'm taking on the Tea Party. I'm really not. I'm taking on a congressman that doesn't reflect the values of the district that I've grown up in and have lived here for 53 years.
Now, you have criticized Justin Amash for voting against the Ryan budget. That was a big marquee billboard facet of the Republican platform. Explain your position on the Ryan budget and the spending cuts and tax cuts that are in there.
Sure. There was $5 trillion of spending reductions over 10 years in the Ryan budget. This was a viable plan that the Republicans put forward, and our congressman couldn't support that. And I just think that that's a bad vote, a wrong vote, and it's out of step with this district. Any time that I have an opportunity to cut $5 trillion out of the government's out-of-control spending, I'm going to be all over that.
Now, here's the thing, Brian Ellis. You say the Ryan budget was a viable program to cut spending. It did pass, and then what happened in Congress was when it was time to vote on actual spending to match the budget, Republicans couldn't pass that. They couldn't match the spending cuts to their very own plan that you would have voted for. It's not as easy as it sounds.
Well, again, when you have $5 trillion of spending on the table, and oh, by the way, that also repealed Obamacare in the Ryan plan. It should have been supported by our congressman. He didn't support it. It doesn't reflect this district, in my opinion, and that's one of the things I'm going to challenge him on.
So let's put you in the current situation. If you were in Congress now and Justin Amash wasn't, as this crisis wears on, where would you be right now? Things have kind of fallen apart. Would you be one of the people pressuring John Boehner from the right, saying, no, don't back down. You should still try to repeal Obamacare or don't open the government? Or would you be looking for more of a compromise here?
Well, I'm not privy to all the conversations that the Republicans are having internally, but all I know is what I see back here, and I think the people want their government open and functioning, and we do not want to be playing chicken with the debt ceiling. But I think the Republicans are perfectly within their rights to bring up excessive spending as a trade-off in this debate. And I've been frustrated that the Democrats haven't come to the table to talk until, you know, maybe this weekend we're starting to see some changes. But, you know, this debt ceiling is very serious, and you do not want to trifle with that. I take the full faith and credit of the United States is kind of sacrosanct, and we shouldn't be playing chicken with it.
Now, you run a financial firm. Is that correct, Mr. Ellis?
Correct.
So you're the kind of guy who would really know the consequences of a debt limit breach, I take it.
I mean, I'd like to think I do, yes. I mean, this is what I watch every day. This is what I pay attention to, and a debt ceiling breach or a default would roil the financial markets and not be good for everyone.
So as somebody with such a strong business background and a businessman, you know, everybody wants to say, hey, Ellis is the traditional pro-business Republican who may be conservative, sure, pro-life, sure, but doesn't want his party running around messing with the basis, with sort of the stability of the U.S. economy, with things like shutdowns and debt limit fights. Is that an accurate portrayal of sort of where you're at here?
Yeah, I don't think that's too far off. A lot of these things, you know, what are we portraying within our country? What are we portraying to the rest of the world through this whole process? And I'm not sure we're putting our best foot forward. It doesn't project a strong America. You know, it's okay to have differences, but you have to get to the table and talk, and that has been sorely lacking, and they're sort of reluctantly talking almost because they have to, and I don't think that's any way to run a country.
This sounds like sort of a basic question, but where are you on the issue of compromise? You know, every politician says they're willing to compromise, but their principles are important. In a situation like this, you know, Tea Party members of Congress get blamed a lot for a refusal to compromise with their own party, with John Boehner. Forget about the Democrats. If you were in Congress now, would you be looking for a way to cut a deal here, or saying this is our opportunity to really take the country in a direction that you think is the best way?
You have to try and move the ball forward every day. And sometimes you get that in big increments, sometimes you get that in small increments, but not moving our country forward is not an option in my mind. And so you have to – it's not a dictatorship. It's a democracy. So you have to work within your party. You have to work across the aisle to move the ball forward, and that's what I hope to bring.
You know, a lot of folks in your party think it is a dictatorship, and that's what they accuse President Obama of having wrought on this country.
Well, I don't know about that, but he's sorely unengaged in this process from where I sit. Again, I'm not privy to everything, but you now maybe have the Senate Democrats reluctantly starting to talk, but the president seems to be AWOL in this whole process.
And before we let you go here, Brian Ellis, what about your own contributions to your campaign? What kind of groups are contributing to you? Are the Chamber of Commerce and the traditional Republican pro-business groups getting behind you against Justin Amash here?
Well, sure. I've had a lot of interest. I'm just getting started. I plan on appealing to a broad swath of people in the district, and I have every confidence I'm going to get contributions from all quarters. There's every indication of that, and the money's already rolling in, but it's only been not even a week here.
A brand-new campaign. We're going to be watching this primary. That's Michigan investment manager and GOP candidate for Congress, Brian Ellis. He is challenging Congressman Justin Amash. He's from Grand Rapids, Michigan, a conservative Republican challenging a Tea Party member. We'll be watching. Mr. Ellis, thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Well, it's Monday. We here at The Takeaway are working, of course. I hope that most of you have the day off for Columbus Day. Maybe some time to shop for name brand electronics at low, low prices. Isn't that what you do on Columbus Day in this country? Now, some of you, the lucky ones, might have shorter schedules every week, not just on a holiday like today, in the form of what's known as the compressed work week, still 40 hours, but compressed so that it's made up of 4 10-hour days instead of the usual 5 8-hour days. New York's Families and Work Institute reported in 2012 that 36%, over a third, of workplaces offer that compressed work week, at least part of the year. These workplaces include some big companies you've heard of, like Blue Cross and General Motors. Well, Jim Browdy has been researching the 4-day work week for the Boston Globe. He's co-host of WGBH's Boston Public Radio. Hi, Jim.
How are you, Todd? I haven't just been researching. I've been pining for the 4-day work week.
And I know that you don't have one because I've been on your show and the tables have turned, and I think I've been on maybe each of the 5 days. So you don't enjoy the 4-day work week yourself.
Not as a regular thing, but in light of the fact that I'm working today, when I was thinking about that, I am off next Tuesday. And I have to say the excitement, and I mean this sincerely, is already building in anticipation.
And that makes me go right to the important question, which is the advent of the 4-day work week. Sure, people would like to have a day off, but you're sort of finding that this can have real implications for people's quality of life and just how they live, what they can get done. What's the real rationale of the of cramming your 40 hours into 4 days instead of five?
Well, there are many rationales. I mean, I spoke to this guy, Brad Harrington, who runs something called the Boston College Center for Work and Family. And he was saying that the more we become a results-based culture, it's going to matter a lot less where we work, when we work, how we work, as long as the job gets done. And, you know, we're all so busy, Todd. There's so many things going on, whether it's kids or parents or just wanting to sleep or shop on a day that where it's not packed. The notion that you could add an extra day to the two you already have has wild appeal. I didn't speak to one person with a 4-day work week, Todd, and I spoke to a lot who was not thrilled to have it. There's some who don't have it, who aren't crazy about the prospect, but those who do love it.
I mean, it's almost as simple as being able to go to the bank in person when it's open. And if you work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, that's hard to do. But anybody with kids would, I guess, love to have a day off in the middle of the week where they can just get stuff done that needs to get done.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to go to the bank any day, but putting that aside, the kid thing is a big deal. And also, a lot of people I spoke to said, I just like sleeping in an extra day. I like to be able to do the hobby that is I haven't had time for through most of my life. So it's a quality of life thing for a lot of people. And by the way, some people with whom I spoke said, I need to do a second job, and I'm able to work either overtime or another job on a Friday. So the rationales are many. It's just that while people have embraced, obviously, for the last 70 years or the 5-day work week, there's a little more trepidation here. I guess it's perceived to be a little more radical, though it shouldn't be.
Now, we're not also necessarily talking about just Fridays. I mean, that's sort of the logical choice, is you get a Friday off if you work the rest of the week harder. But businesses, I imagine, wouldn't like that because they don't want the whole thing slowing down on Friday. So they would have to stagger everybody, right? Different days.
Yeah. A lot, I mean, the hospital industry, for example, a lot of doctors, particularly women doctors, a lot of nurses, some by some accounts, a majority. That's happening. There are a lot of production facilities that want to keep working around the clock. They do that. But as you say, stagger. I really worked hard to find some powerful arguments against this. And in some industries, I guess I got it. But I think it's just that the way we do things is we do them 5 days, and so we're not going to change. I didn't hear a wildly powerful argument against it.
Well, what's the best argument you did hear against it?
The best argument is that I can't deal with the stress and the fatigue that comes with working 10-hour days. You know, you kids can do it, they'd say, but I just can't. I'm too advanced in my work life. I can't do it anymore. And by the way, I'm not suggesting it be mandated. I'm just suggesting the option should be there for those who want it. You know, I mentioned the Utah example. The first major experiment, at least I'm aware of, is when John Huntsman, who people know ran for the Republican nomination for president, Todd, in 2012, as you know, when he was governor in 2008, implemented it for about 70 to 80% of his 17,000 state workers. And while it was repealed 3 years later by the legislature after he had left the governorship, interviews with taxpayers and workers and people in government who had to deal with their competitors in the state, the Googles and the Microsofts, there were rave reviews. So where it's happened, as I said, the response has been great.
And there is a lot of, they call it flex work time in the federal government. Living in the Beltway myself, I know a lot of my bureaucrat friends have alternate Fridays off, especially in the summer. It's kind of a common thing in the federal government. But I was a little surprised to read that labor unions and labor activists haven't been more vocal about this one.
Well, first of all, in terms of the federal, since you mentioned it, Todd, I think they are perfecting the zero-day work week, both in Congress
days,
and beyond.
I should have said, yes.
I'll write about that sometime in the future. Unions, it's not that they – I spoke to a lot – by the way, I used to be a union president myself, so I have great sympathies there and a little bit of history. It wasn't that the labor leaders with whom I spoke were saying, I'm not into this. In manufacturing, particularly in auto, there's a lot of this, I should say. Airline industry, the same way. It's just that they had other priorities, other flex time priorities, other flexibility thing. So it wasn't that they were saying we don't want to do this and it's not on our list. It just wasn't number one on theirs like it is at least on mine.
So Jim Browdy, are you gonna lead here? Are you gonna lead from Boston Public Radio? Are you guys gonna go to the 4-day show and have somebody do alternate Fridays for you?
I haven't broached this with my boss yet, Todd, and so I'm waiting for the proper moment. And I'm hoping he read the Sunday Boston Globe magazine, and he'll get a sense of this. And it may be a little bit more difficult for people who do what you do and what we do here, but for the vast majority of the workforce, and by the way, I have my Nostradamus-like powers are virtually non-existent. But I would say for the vast majority of the workforce in America, particularly with shrinking paychecks, I think shrinking hours are in our future. Not fewer hours in total, but fewer days. I think in 10 years, this is going to be the norm.
We're going to be looking forward to that. Read in the pages of the Boston Globe some new work and new research from Jim Browdy on the compressed, not shorter, but compressed 4-day work week. He's also co-host of WGBH's Boston Public Radio. Jim, great to talk to you again.
You too, Todd. Thanks.
For the rest of the week, we're going to be taking a look at how America's relationship to faith is changing. According to the Pew Forum on Religious and Public Life, more young people than ever say they have departed from religion entirely. One in four millennials are not affiliated with any religion, describing their religion as atheist or agnostic or nothing in particular. We'll begin the week hearing from young Jewish Americans who have departed from their faith and now call themselves secular Jews. Take a listen.
Among my friends, I'm known as the guy who makes really great breakfast tacos with bacon in them.
I'm an atheist, but I do believe in the power of ritual and prayer.
I'm just as likely to read a story of the Tower of Babel in the Bible as I am to read a story by Isaac Babel, the Russian Jewish writer, and get as much inspiration from one as I do from the other.
And later in the week, Christians turned humanists and young Muslim Americans who are turning on the traditions and beliefs of their parents' generations. And we'll end the week hearing from the other side of the story, young Americans who remain deeply religious and connected to their religious communities. We'll explore all this in our series, Young Nation Under God. As always, we want your take. Do you associate with a particular religion? Have you moved away from one? Are you atheist or agnostic? Do you believe faith is still a core value in America? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're collecting your stories and playing them on the air all next week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is back tomorrow. Don't worry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.